Good morning. I think we're ready to call the meeting to order. This is an open meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board on Tuesday, December 14th, 2010. I'd like to welcome everyone who's joined us here in person and those listening to the webcast this morning. Today, the board will formally commence its implementation of the broker-dealer oversight provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act by considering a recommendation to propose a temporary rule related to an interim inspection program for broker-dealer audits and a recommendation to propose rules related to assessing and collecting a portion of the board's accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund the PCOB's oversight of audits of brokers and dealers. And we'll also be considering some related amendments to the funding rules for issuers. Before we proceed with the agenda, I'll note for the record that all of the board members are present this morning. The first order of business before the board today is a staff recommendation that the board issue a release proposing a temporary rule to establish an interim inspection program related to audits of brokers and dealers. And to present the staff recommendation on this item, we'll turn to our general counsel's office, Michael Stevenson and Bob Burns. And Gordon Seymour.
Thanks, Chairman Gelser. And before Michael Stevenson and presents the staff's recommendation, I do want to just introduce the topic. Today, as you noted, we're here to recommend that the board propose a temporary rule to commence an interim program of inspection of broker-dealer audits. As you noted, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act amended the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to expand the board's regulatory authority, which, as the PCB's name itself reflects, had previously been focused on audits of public companies. As amended, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act authorizes the board to carry out the same oversight responsibilities with respect to audits of securities brokers and dealers as the board has to date been carrying out with respect to audits of public companies. That is, setting standards that govern the audits, conducting a program of regular inspections to assess auditors' compliance with laws, rules, and standards, and where appropriate, conducting investigations and imposing disciplinary sanctions. We're here today to recommend that the board take the first rulemaking step towards implementing that new authority. In a moment, Michael Stevenson will present the staff's recommendation. Before he does so, though, I do want to thank both Michael and Bob Burns from the Office of General Counsel for their thoughtful and careful work on the release before you today. I also want to acknowledge the assistance of George Dicont and Bob Monday in particular from our inspections division, who have been very helpful in our efforts to put together the proposal before you. And with that, I'll turn things over to Michael to describe the release.
Thank you, Gordon.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. We're recommending this morning that the board propose and seek public comment on a temporary rule to establish an interim program related to audits, an interim inspection program related to audits of brokers and dealers. I'd like to begin by explaining why we're talking today about a temporary rule and an interim program rather than a permanent rule and program. The Act, as amended, authorizes the board to inspect auditors of broker dealers, but to do so, the board must first establish an inspection program by rule. The Act does not prescribe the elements of that inspection program and instead leaves it to the board to resolve some important questions about that program. For example, the Act provides that the board's inspection program may allow for differentiation among classes of brokers and dealers, but it does not require any differentiation. A more narrowly focused provision of the Act requires that the board consider whether differing inspection schedules would be appropriate with respect to auditors that issue audit reports only for introducing brokers or dealers, that is, those brokers and dealers that do not receive, handle, or hold customer securities or cash, or are not members of the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. But the Act does not require differing inspection schedules for those auditors or limit the range of possible schedules the board might establish. The Act permits the board to differentiate in the inspection program even to the extent of completely excluding some categories of broker-dealer auditors from the inspection requirement, which in this context would also have the effect of exempting those firms from the requirement to be registered with the PCAOB. These are significant issues that the board must address in establishing a permanent inspection program. To guide the board, the Act specifies no criteria other than its core directive to the board, quote, to oversee the audit of companies that are subject to the securities laws and related matters in order to protect the interests of investors and further the public interest in the preparation of informative, accurate, and independent audit reports, close quote. Establishing a permanent inspection program that appropriately protects and furthers those interests involves consideration of how the conduct of registered firms in different categories can affect investors and threaten the public interest, as well as consideration of cost and regulatory burdens on different categories of registered public accounting firms and classes of brokers and dealers. The premise of our recommendation this morning to propose a temporary rule for an interim program is that the board is not currently in a position to make sufficiently informed judgments on these issues to establish a permanent program. A temporary rule for an interim program, however, would serve two purposes. First, it would allow the board at least to begin assessing registered public accounting firms' audits of brokers and dealers without delaying all such inspection work until the board can reach and the SEC approve final resolution of the points I've described. Second, an interim inspection program would provide a source of information that could help guide decisions about the scope and elements of a permanent program. To inform the board's determinations about a permanent program, the proposed interim program would include within its scope all categories of registered public accounting firms that audit brokers and dealers, and all classes of securities brokers and dealers audited by them. The proposing release makes clear, though, that the inclusive scope of the interim program should not be construed as either foreshadowing the likely scope of a permanent program or suggesting that every broker-dealer auditor will be subject to inspection procedures as part of the interim program. The substantive focus of inspection procedures in the interim program would be on assessing compliance with the standards and rules that govern the auditor's work at the time that work is performed. Although the board now has the authority to set, subject to SEC approval, standards for broker-dealer audits, the board has not yet done so, and this proposed temporary rule would not do so. The proposing release cites recent guidance that the SEC and its staff have provided regarding standards and rules that currently govern broker-dealer audits. The proposing release also points out that for audits performed under the standards and rules that currently apply, inspection procedures would take appropriate account of the interpretive guidance in the AICPA broker-dealer audit guide. Inspection procedures would also assess auditors' execution of steps described in SEC Rule 17A5, which requires, among other things, that the audit include a review of the broker-dealer's accounting system and include a review of the internal accounting control and procedures for safeguarding securities. Under Rule 17A5, the audit should include all procedures necessary to enable the auditor to express an opinion on financial statements and on the broker's or dealer's compliance with SEC and other rules related to net capital computations, required reserve computations, and the possession or control of customer assets. Inspection procedures performed in the interim program would be in accordance with and subject to the provisions of Section 104 of the Act. Among other things, that would mean that the Act's provisions concerning the confidentiality of inspection information would apply to the interim program. As with any board inspection, the inspection procedures would involve identifying audit deficiencies and bringing them to the firm's attention with the expectation that the firm will address the deficiencies and take steps to avoid future such deficiencies. The board would also report to the SEC and could report to FINRA and certain other authorities information suggesting violations of law and rules by brokers and dealers. In addition, if appropriate, information obtained through the inspection program could lead to the PCAOB imposing disciplinary sanctions against a registered public accounting firm or its associated persons. With that in mind, the rule proposal amends the definitions of certain terms as used in the board's enforcement rules so that they conform with the Act's new definition of those terms and encompass broker-dealer audits. The proposed temporary rule provides that no less frequently than every 12 months, the board will publish a report on the interim program. Each report would describe the progress of the interim program and any significant observations from the program. Each report would be a general report covering inspection procedures at many firms and, like the general reports that the board has issued under its Rule 4010, would not identify specific brokers or dealers or specific auditors. Firm-specific inspection reports related to broker-dealer audits, however, would be deferred until a permanent program is established. There are two principal reasons for this. First, because the SEC has announced its intention to propose amendments to Rule 17A5, and because the board will likely adopt standards and rules that, if approved by the SEC, would govern the conduct of broker-dealer audits, it's reasonably clear that the standards and rules applicable to those audits will change over the next 2 years. During the interim program, the board will be obtaining a broad view of practice at a time when the standards and rules applicable to the audits will be evolving. Before finalizing its inspection of any one firm, including by articulating quality control criticisms that would be publicly exposed if the firm failed to address them, it will be useful to have that broad view of past practice and knowledge of the standards that will apply going forward. This will contribute to consistent and meaningful evaluations of the types of issues that firms need to address in their broker-dealer audit practices. Second, the proposing release explains that if any category of registered public accounting firms is exempted from the permanent program, the board would not issue individual reports on any firms in the exempted category that had their work reviewed during the interim program. Until a permanent program is finalized, though, it won't be known what, if any, categories of firms will be exempt. For those reasons, inspection procedures performed on a firm as part of the interim program would be treated as a foundational portion of the first inspection of the firm's broker and dealer audit practice, which eventually would be completed and encompassed within a firm-specific inspection report following the establishment of the permanent program, if the firm is included in the permanent program. Subject to consideration of public comments, we expect that the board will be in a position to adopt a version of the temporary rule in 2011. Although we also expect that inspection procedures may begin with the voluntary cooperation of some firms even before a rule is adopted. If the board adopts the rule and the commission approves it, the release describes an expectation that procedures under the interim program would be carried out in 2011 and 2012 and possibly into 2013, and that by 2013 the board would be in a position to propose rules for a permanent program. We'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Let me ask the other board members if there are any motions regarding this matter.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Niemeyer.
I move that the board instruct the staff to release the proposed temporary rule on inspections of audits of brokers and dealers as recommended for public comment for a period of 60 days.
Thank you very much. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Let me make a statement about this matter also, and then we'll turn to some discussion. One of the board's major tasks during the next year will be implementation of the new responsibilities for auditors of broker-dealers. As we've already heard, Section 982 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act gave the board inspections, standard setting, and enforcement authority over auditors of all SEC-registered securities brokers and dealers. Since the end of 2008, those auditors have been required to register with the board, but have not otherwise been subject to PCAOB authority. The temporary interim inspection rule the board is considering today is a first step down the road of turning that new authority into a functioning oversight program. These new responsibilities will have a significant effect on our work. There are about 5,000 broker-dealers. In the past 2 years, over 500 accounting firms have registered with the board because they audit broker-dealers. In addition, many previously registered firms that audit issuers also have broker-dealer practices. While there are a handful of mega firms, most broker-dealers are very small. Less than 1%, 33 firms, have net capital in excess of $1 billion. Those 33 firms hold over 80% of the net capital in the entire broker-dealer industry. At the other end of the spectrum, 70% of all broker-dealers have tentative net capital under $1 million. Collectively, those firms have less than 1% of industry net capital. As to activities, the pattern is similar. About 520 brokerage firms provide clearing or custodial services. Many of the others are introducing firms that, at least in theory, do not have access to client funds or securities. Some are floor brokers without public clients. Some are insurance agents that sell products that are technically securities. Some are finders active in the M&A market. Some are captives that serve the trading needs of a single affiliated client. Other categories undoubtedly exist. This diversity raises questions about whether we should devote resources to inspecting the auditors of all these types of brokers and dealers, or whether some of their auditors can safely be exempted from PCAOB oversight without compromising investor protection. While the board does not yet have the answers to those questions, the temporary rule will allow the board to begin inspections of broker-dealer audits so that we can develop an empirical basis on which to eventually address them. The interim inspections will focus both on reviewing the work performed on specific audits and on gathering facts to inform the board's consideration of a permanent program. The information gathering aspect of the interim inspections will provide the board with insight about the potential benefits of broker-dealer inspections to the investing public and about the potential costs and regulatory burdens that would be imposed on different categories of accounting firms and classes of brokers. Armed with this type of information, the board will be in a better position to decide on possible exemptions from oversight and to determine the objectives, nature, and frequency of inspections for firms that remain subject to PCAOB jurisdiction. Decisions about the permanent inspection program are probably at least a year away. In the meantime, there will be ample opportunity for the public to learn what the board is finding in the interim program and to participate in the decision process. The proposed temporary rule provides for transparency in that the board will issue public reports at least annually on the progress of the interim program and on any significant observations. The permanent broker-dealer auditor inspection program will be predicated on rules that will only be adopted by the board after public notice and comment and will only take effect after Securities and Exchange Commission approval. The board will also issue firm-specific reports on the inspections performed in the interim program, just as it does under the existing public company auditor inspection program. However, the release accompanying the proposed rule envisions that the firm-specific reports will not be finalized until the firms in question have had an inspection in the permanent program. Nonetheless, the interim program will include identifying and promptly addressing with the inspected firm any significant audit issues the board uncovers. That may include taking disciplinary action if appropriate. In addition, the board will refer information about potential broker-dealer violations to the commission and to the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. While the interim broker-dealer auditor inspection program will be carried out by the inspection staff, this rulemaking has largely been the responsibility of the Office of the General Counsel under the dedicated leadership of the board's General Counsel, Gordon Seymour. I want particularly to thank Michael Stevenson, Deputy General Counsel, and Bob Burns, Associate General Counsel, for the work and, more importantly, the thought that's gone into the proposed temporary rule. And I should also acknowledge the assistance of Bob Madej, who's really our resident expert on broker-dealer auditing, and, of course, George Diakont, the head of the inspection staff. Let me turn then to the other board members and ask if they have any comments or questions that they'd like to raise about this matter. And let me start with Mr. Niemeyer, since you made the motion.
Thank you, Chairman Gelzer. I do have a few comments. I support this proposal to use inspections to collect information about the risk associated with broker-dealer audits. The Dodd-Frank Act directs the board to set the scope of our new oversight program, including to determine whether to differentiate among categories of brokers and dealers, or whether to exclude from the inspection program any categories of auditors. In my view, it would be imprudent to try to make such determinations without a careful fact-finding study of the risk and cost involved. Inspections will give us varnished insights into both regards. Meanwhile, given the widespread public concerns about the risk of another scandal like Madoff, I think it's a good idea not to delay inspections pending what ought to be a thoughtful process with meaningful public comment to determine what kinds of audits should be subject to what kind of inspection. Inspections will also help us, and I expect the SEC too, resolve some significant uncertainties that are still outstanding. For example, the SEC recently reminded auditors of the existing requirement to obtain sufficient basis to provide reasonable assurance on certain compliance assertions under the profession zone standards. Based on a review of numerous audit reports filed with such assertions, though, it appears that many auditors have merely been providing negative assurance. This obviously needs to change, and our inspections can monitor how firms do. In addition, as the chairman of the SEC has announced, the commission will take up a proposal to amend SEC Rule 17A5 in the near future, which will, among other things, address the nature of the compliance assertions that broker-dealers must make, as well as the nature of auditor assurance that will be required on those assertions. I hope our inspections will help inform the SEC about what's working under the current system and what's not. Finally, based on the SEC's rulemaking, the PCAOB will need to develop appropriate audit standards to meet the SEC's requirements. We will certainly be in a much better position to make thoughtful judgments about appropriate procedures and audit scope once we've had a chance to field test audits under existing standards. To be sure, this is not a proposal to commence inspections full bore. It is precisely because of these uncertainties that commencing a full inspection program today is not practicable. But there is much to be gained from an interim inspection program by all parties involved, including the PCAOB, the SEC, the audit profession, broker-dealers, and their customers. Before I close, I'd like to express thanks also for the excellent work that's gone into this proposal from my general counsel's office, Gordon Seymour, Michael Stevenson, Bob Burns, as well as Bob Madej from our inspection division. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Mr. Harris, do you have any comments or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support both items we will vote on this morning, the proposed temporary rule for an interim program of inspections of broker-dealer audits, and the proposed allocation of the board's accounting support fee among issuers, brokers, and dealers. With respect to the temporary rule for an interim program of inspections, the rule would allow the board to start inspections of firms' work on broker-dealer audits, but would also defer deciding the more complex questions about the scope of a permanent program until the board has more information, including information gathered through the interim program. Let me focus on one such complex question that involves specifically the treatment of introducing broker-dealers and whether they should be exempted from inspection and regulation, as some are suggesting. I believe this proposed temporary rule is a responsible reflection of the legislative history underlying Section 982 of the Dodd-Frank Act dealing with broker-dealers. While there was considerable debate surrounding the provision, Section 982 ultimately provided for no outright exemption from PCAOB oversight at this time. Initially, in the House of Representatives, the ranking member of the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets, Congressman Scott Garrett, offered an amendment to exempt the auditors of introducing broker-dealers from the bill's new requirements. However, the amendment was rejected during the committee markup by a vote of 43-26. A compromise provision sponsored by Subcommittee Chairman Paul Kaczynski and Congressman Garrett was then reached and passed by the full House as part of Chairman Frank's manager's amendment. During the House deliberations, both the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Securities Investor Protection Corporation weighed in against the statutory exemption in separate letters to the Congress. At the same time, the SEC's chief accountant noted that, quote, failing to provide PCAOB authority over auditors of all broker-dealers would perpetuate two sets of auditing standards, which would provide no clarity to investors as to the level of audit that is being performed at each broker-dealer, close quote. And SIPC noted that since 1995, the agency liquidated 52 introducing brokers at a cost of more than $137 million. In the Senate, the bill, as introduced and passed, did not mandate any broker-dealer exemptions. The Senate committee report simply included language from SIPC saying, quote, the PCOB's new oversight authority should apply to audits of all registered broker-dealers and dealers, and not only those that perform a clearing function or carry customer accounts. Ultimately, the compromise that passed the House was offered by Representatives Garrett and Kanjorski during the Commerce Committee proceedings and was agreed to by both the House and Senate conferees. The agreed-upon statutory outcome, in effect, delegates to the Board the decision by rule and with Commission approval whether to exempt auditors of certain categories of broker-dealers from the Board's inspection program. I believe the proposed temporary rule we are considering today would allow the Board the necessary time to gather and assess the relevant information needed to adequately determine if any exemption is appropriate and in the best interest of investors. While the temporary inspection rules anticipate that firm-specific inspection reports would not begin until after a permanent program takes effect, it is important to note that the Board will still take disciplinary action as appropriate against an auditor where inspections under the interim program have identified significant issues in the firm's audit work. The proposed rule also makes clear that the Board will be mindful of the potential costs and regulatory burdens that might be imposed on a different category on different categories of a registered public accounting firms and classes of brokers and dealers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Gradison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to join my colleagues in thanking the staff for bringing us to this point today. I think it's very important, and I think it builds upon our experience back in 2003 when limited inspections were carried out, even before we had the authority to carry out inspections, with the voluntary permission of the four largest firms. In each case, 16 inspections were done, and I think that played a very valuable role in helping to guide the Board and the staff in putting together a more permanent program. I used to be in this business. I was a general partner and later a shareholder of a non-public broker-dealer, and I've been trying to sort this out in my own mind. Certainly, there is a common denominator between our traditional role of inspecting issuers with the goal of protecting investors, because this has to do with protecting investors as well. But there is a very important difference, and that is that the focus with regard to issuers is on the financial reports, doing what we can to make sure that they're accurate and reliable and audited in an independent manner. And that's okay. I mean, that's useful with regard to broker-dealers, but in some respects, the financial reports are just the beginning, because the key protection to investors has to do with the safekeeping of securities and cash that are held. I particularly want to associate myself with the comments of Mr. Harris and thank him for making the point about the significant losses incurred by SIPC with regard to so-called introducing brokers. Self-assessment as being introducing only. Now, obviously, it doesn't necessarily mean that there was no control of cash or securities by those firms, or those losses would not have occurred. I know the Board is fully aware of this, and that the staff will be taking a look at questions like this and looking to the future. But since I may not be around at the time, certainly who knows anymore, but I'm assuming that when the final rules are written, they'll be written by others. I just want to make this comment that I'm aware that it's a daunting task to think about inspecting 4,500, 5,000, whatever it is, audits of broker-dealers, but I don't think that we should, and I'm not suggesting this would happen, but I don't think we should let this the daunting number of allegedly introducing brokers stand in the way of what is necessary to protect investors. And these investors are not fully protected by SIPC. SIPC plays a very important role, but there are limits on the degree of protection which it provides. So investors are still at risk, even if the firm they deal with participates in the CIPIC program.
Thank you, Mr. Gradison. Let me ask you a couple questions about some of the points that have been mentioned in the discussion. And first, it's been said a couple of times that there are between 4,500 and 5,000 broker-dealers in the United States registered with the SEC. How many of those do you envision will be inspected under the interim program? Or how many will be inspected in 2011, for example?
I think the scope of the full interim program, how many audits that will ultimately reach, remains to be seen. I would say that the number of broker-dealer audits reviewed in the interim program would be a small percentage of the 4,500 to 5,000 audits that are out there, broker-dealers that are out there. And it's probably the case that a relatively low percentage of registered firms that audit broker-dealers but don't audit issuers would be subject to procedures in the interim program. In 2011, I think we anticipate that probably be fewer than 100 broker-dealer audits subject to inspection procedures, and that would include audits of a cross-section of types of brokers and dealers.
So probably most broker-dealers won't see a PCAOB inspector in the interim program.
Most broker-dealer auditors. That don't also audit issuers, that's right.
I think we've often said publicly that in the issuer inspection program, we take a risk-based approach to selecting engagements to review. The interim program has somewhat different objectives, and will risk, in the same sense, play a role in selecting engagements in the interim program, or are we going to select engagements more to get a cross-section of the industry, or what will be the selection basis?
I think there would be a mix of factors at work, and as your question sort of alludes to, one of the important purposes of the interim program is, in fact, to inform the board about where the risks are in this context, and you know, the risks posed to investors and to the public interest by deficient auditing with respect to different types of brokers and dealers may differ, and part of the interim program will be to identify for the board where those risks are, what those risks are, where they lie, and to what extent, if any, each type of risk should factor into an approach to an inspection.
Okay. And when we do these interim inspections, what will we be looking at in terms of years covered? As if we select a firm for inspection in 2011, that means we'll be looking at audit work performed in 2011 or audit work performed in 2010? Or is there more of a reach back, look back element?
I think typically what would happen is the inspectors would look at work related to whenever the most recent audit report was issued. So they're in the interim program in 2011, inspecting a firm that's audited a broker-dealer's 2010 year-end financial statements, they'd look at the audit that went into the audit report issued in early 2011. That's not to rule out looking back further than that. I think it's unlikely that the program would look at work that related to audit reports that were issued before the Dodd-Frank amendments in July 21st.
But you don't feel that that's a jurisdictional limit on our inspection program, that we could look at earlier work?
Well, I think we'd address that question if it came up that it was important to look at, for some reason, to look at audits before that. I don't think we've tried to reach a conclusion about that today.
Okay. And I think you did mention in your statement about the possibility of beginning inspections before the temporary rule takes effect on a voluntary basis with some firms. And maybe just to clarify a point, I think I know the answer to this one, but I assume once the rule is adopted, cooperation won't be an option for firms that receive an inspection notice. In other words, our same authority to require firms to cooperate in an inspection or to discipline them if they don't will apply to this program as applied to the issuer program.
That's right. The board's current rule, 4006, is a rule that implements that authority and requires cooperation in inspections. And the temporary rule specifically incorporates rule 4006 in the interim program. So, yes, cooperation would be required.
You might elaborate on another point. There's been some discussion of the fact that the SEC has issued a statement essentially saying that broker-dealer auditors should continue to follow the existing GAAP pending PCAOB adoption of auditing standards governing broker-dealer audits. And as I understand it, that essentially means the AICPA's broker-dealer audit guide. At least that's the most direct guidance on the subject. But that, again, if I understand correctly, it's an interpretive publication, and its content is what I think the AICPA, or the guide itself, calls recommendations. How, if there aren't definitive standards, how are we going to reach conclusion in inspections about whether people follow the standards or not?
Well, let me try to break that into two pieces, and I'll take the first piece and ask Bob to address the second piece. And first piece, I think it's important to remember that while the guide is referred to in the standards, it's the standards that govern the audit, and it's the standards that the board hold the firms to in this context. That's not to say it wouldn't take that assessing the work wouldn't take account of what's in the guide, but to your question.
And when you say the standards, you mean the standards the Auditing Standards Board has.
That's right. So it's not as if, you know, the guide in the form of something that's only a recommendation is the only thing that governs the audit. I don't know, Bob, do you want to add anything?
No, I think that's basically it. Rule 17A5 put out by the SEC essentially says that the auditor should follow generally accepted auditing standards, and in generally accepted auditing standards there's various procedures that have to be followed, and there's also certain test standards that have to be followed. The AICPA has put out the broker-dealer audit guide as an interpretation as to what GAAS and Rule 17A5 require. So I think the board staff would use the guide the same way that the profession does, essentially as interpretive guidance as to what GAAS requires or what GAAS means. And so we would look to that as an interpretive or helpful.
So we could bring an enforcement action then against a firm for violating not PCAOB standards, but ASB standards as interpreted in the guide, assuming that we discovered a violation.
Well, eventually it gets back. Rule 17A5, which is an SEC rule, which the board has the authority to enforce, requires that they follow GAAS, generally accepted auditing standards. So, yes, I think in enforcing the SEC's rules, we would end up in the same place.
Right.
Will there be any, I guess our auditing standard number 7, engagement quality review, will not apply to these audits, at least currently?
Right, currently it will not, yes.
Is there any concurrent partner review requirement that's currently applicable to them?
Not that I'm aware of. Not applicable to the audits of brokers and dealers. I don't believe so. Under GAAS as it exists now.
I would add, it may be that firms have concurrent reviews or have concurrent reviews done on those audits, even though they're not required. And to the extent that's the case, certainly look at that in the inspection, the extent to which the firm is complying with its own policies just as it relates generally to quality control.
All right, well, maybe I ask a couple of things about the firm-specific reports that will be issued. Now, as I understand it, we would not issue a report coming out of the inspection, or immediately coming out of the inspection in the interim review, but instead, assuming that the firm was part of the permanent program, then a report encompassing the work done in the interim inspection program would be issued after the firm had its first inspection in the permanent program. Is that all accurate?
That's correct.
So there'd be quite a gap then presumably between the time that a report issues coming out of the encompassing the interim program work and the time that that field work is actually performed, probably three or four years, I suppose.
There could be, yeah. Essentially, the recommendation is that the board begin performing inspection procedures under the interim program for the reasons we've been talking about, but that with respect to any particular firm, those procedures should be understood as the beginning or the foundation of the board's first inspection, full inspection of that firm's broker-dealer audit practice, which would sort of be rounded out once there's a permanent program in place after new standards have been established and the board has developed a broad view of what practice had been under the current standards.
How will remediation work then? I mean, the obligation to remediate isn't triggered until we issue a report. If we're issuing a report several years, at least after the work has done, the nature of the firm may have changed, the nature of its practice may have changed.
Obviously, there are details to be worked out, and I don't want my answer to sound like too much of this has been predetermined, but you know, what I would expect is that the inspection would be rounded out after the permanent program is in place and result in a report that sort of fairly assesses quality control issues at that point in time with respect to that firm. And in doing so, would certainly take account of any observations from the interim program that remain relevant and factor those into a meaningful evaluation of the firm's quality control system at that time and an assessment of what the firm should be trying to address and remediate in the 12 months following that time. And so the observations from the interim program wouldn't be lost for all time, but you're right, there would be a delay in how they relate to the quality control.
Yeah, just to add to that, I mean, the standards will be evolving over that period of time. So, again, it depends on what would be relevant at the time that the report would come out, because we may end up with PCOB standards that may be somewhat different than the ACPA standards today. So,
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me these sort of delayed reports on the interim inspections are a clever way of solving a legal problem for us. In other words, we're required to issue a report coming out of an inspection, but given the nature and purpose of the interim inspections, they may not necessarily conveniently lead to firm-specific reports. So it'll be rolled into the second inspection of the firm, so that we meet our obligation to issue a report. Is that an overstatement?
Well, you're right that there's a legal issue. I don't know that I would characterize what we're doing here as a clever way to solve a legal problem. I think
that is a compliment.
Okay. Well, thank you. But I do think that what we're proposing to make sense and stands alone on its face. It makes sense to go out and start doing inspection work on broker-dealer audits. It makes sense to focus on gathering information and focus on what a permanent program should be. It makes sense, I think, not to issue inspection reports on any firms that are eventually exempted from the permanent program. If any category firm is exempted, it would make sense not to issue inspection reports on the small number of firms in that category that would have been subject to interim procedures. So, and finally, I think it makes sense at some point to do a report on firms in the permanent program, a report that doesn't ignore what we saw during the interim program. So I would suggest that it's a sensible and fortunately, it's a sensible approach and fortunately addresses a legal issue as well.
Well, I certainly agree. One last question. I guess you might call this a practical question, at least from the perspective of the firms involved. If I understand correctly, under most state laws today, if you're engaged in auditing, you're subject, or you have to have a peer review of your audit work. But there's an exception if you're being inspected. So the firms where we inspect their issuer audit work don't separately have to have a peer review. Are the 500-plus auditors of broker-dealers now subject to PCAOB inspection and therefore no longer required to have peer reviews, whether we get around to coming and seeing them or not?
Well, the only thing I'd say, the part of the what would normally be peer review that is being inspected by the PCAOB under a lot of states is exempt, but the peer review generally covers a lot more areas. So I think a lot of firms that are inspected by the PCAOB are still peer reviewed because firms do a lot of other things as well. So there's still peer reviews going on. Insofar as to whether or not our inspecting audits of broker-dealers will result in additional exemptions from the state or other legal requirements or peer reviews, I think that'll be up to each jurisdiction to decide whether or not they want to include them. It's hard for us right now to predict that.
And I think just to get at what I think was another part of your question, whether all of those firms be considered subject to PCAOB inspection because of the interim program, I think they're all subject to inspection in the sense that any one of them might be inspected in the program, but not in the sense that there's some mandatory inspection frequency, and then at some point the program would have to touch all of those firms. That's not the case. And as I said before, probably would the interim program would probably touch a relatively small portion of those firms.
This was, as I think you know, this is a question that came up at our small business forum in Miami a couple weeks ago, and I suspect it may be on the minds of many broker-dealer auditors. But I take it that the sort of the bottom line answer is you'd have to check with your state. The answer could vary state by state.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Any other questions or discussion, Mr. Gradison?
Yeah, I don't want the discussion, which has been very valuable, of inspection reports and remediation with regard to the interim program to give anybody on the outside the impression that that nothing may come out of the interim inspections if we find something that's wrong. And I want to draw a parallel. The first time around in the fall of 2003 when we did those interim inspections, and there were only 64 engagements reviewed at the time, led to more than 20 restatements. Now, that's not an exact parallel, though, because the restatements probably wouldn't be, it wouldn't exactly apply here. But I'm really just trying to make the point that while this a very important work that the inspection division will be undertaking will be extremely valuable, it isn't just a learning experience for the PCAOB, and it could have consequences for the firms involved, depending on what we find.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that again, because I think it's worth emphasizing that even without individual inspection reports, there's a lot that goes on in an inspection and a lot that can come of an inspection, including auditors being expected and monitored to see that they're going back and addressing issues that should be addressed. In serious enough cases, referring information about possible broker-dealer violations to the SEC and FINRA. And in serious enough cases, commencing board disciplinary proceedings against the auditors. So those are important points.
I've got a couple of questions.
Yes, Mr. Harris.
Just taking that a step farther, and following up on Bill's comments, could you explain a little bit more fully what enforcement action could be taken in the interim by the PCAOB for a poor inspection finding? And to what extent enforcement would be left to the SEC or FINRA?
Enforcement with respect to brokers and dealers would, in all cases, of course, be left to the SEC and FINRA. With respect to the auditors, the board, and I should highlight something I alluded to in my presentation. We're making the proposal includes updating certain definitions in the board's enforcement rules so that they'll conform with the updated definitions, amended definitions in the Act. And the consequence of that would be that failures by auditors in connection with their obligations under Rule 17A5, including the obligations to conduct the audit in accordance with GAS, would be failures that could be addressed through board disciplinary proceedings. So in a sufficiently serious circumstance, the board would have available the full range of enforcement authority and sanction options as it has today with respect to issuer auditors.
And that's during the interim period? That's throughout any
right. After if the proposed when if and when the proposed rule temporary rule takes effect. Yeah.
And then the chairman referred to the time gaps and the proposed rule and the inspection reports being 2013, which means that for all intents and purposes, I think that remediation would take you into 2014 and there wouldn't be public disclosure potentially until 2015. First of all, is that correct? And then is there any way to expedite any part of that process so we're not, if in fact we do find significant problems during this interim period, we can take remedial action before 2015?
Well, the timeline as you described it is correct. I think the... And it's correct for all the reasons we've been talking about, and it's the I don't know that there's any way to expedite what I think you're asking about, which is the sort of the remediation period, the statutorily prescribed 12-month remediation period that the board allows a firm before determining whether the firm has adequately addressed quality control criticisms. And then making those criticisms public if the firm hasn't addressed them. Of course, obviously, it's preferable in every case that firms address them. We want to see them addressing those criticisms. Where they don't, we make them public. But I don't think, in the context of the framework we're talking about today, there's a way to expedite it. And I would say, in defense of that result, that. Remember that we're talking about a situation or period of 2 or 3 years where standards and practice are going to be evolving, perhaps significantly, and sort of articulating quality control criticisms on the basis of an interim inspection in 2011 of audit work done under the current standards with an expectation that the firm will address that by sometime in 2012. When the standards will be completely different, could be completely different, is part of what goes into sort of weighing the costs and benefits of what we're talking about.
Right, and I would only add to that the fact that because you have all these evolving standards, Rule 17A5 very well may change, the auditing standards may change. Once all those things get into place and broker-dealers adjust their practices in order to conform with the new 17A5, the auditors have to adjust their practices, all that has to be done. Then there have to actually be audits out there that they're performed so that the inspectors can then go in and look at them, and all that takes a period of years to evolve and get in place and have records that we can go in and actually examine with some certainty. So it sounds like a long period of time, but there's a lot that has to go on and a lot that has to be done. So
it's always easier to measure the costs of any program. How do you envision weighing the potential benefits to investors of these inspections versus the cost?
Well, the benefit of the temporary inspection rule, I think, is really great. I think looking at the broker-dealer type audits is a new venture for the board. We haven't really done that before. I think it's very important that the board and its staff get to learn about the broker-dealer industry and about the audits of broker-dealers, and that they get to learn about the board at the same time. I think there's going to be a lot of communication during this interim inspection process both ways. And I think until we get that information, it's very hard to make judgments about what you would really like to have a permanent program look like. We hear a lot of stories. We hear a lot of anecdotal evidence. But I think by the time we get out into the field and actually look at some things, the staff will be able to report back to you some very valid information that you might want to consider before you decide what you really want to do. I think that's a great benefit to everyone concerned, so that we're actually focusing on the right things when the time comes. And so far as the cost on the other side of it, I would point out that at least initially in the interim program, the standards have not changed, so I don't think there should be a big chance as far as in actually performing the audits, at least right now, because the rules are the same as they have been. We'll discuss funding in a few minutes. But I think, as you'll hear, we don't anticipate that there'll be a lot of fees paid by small brokers and dealers to the board on that. So we're hoping that the actual cost to the broker dealers won't be that great either.
And I know you're taking a very methodical, deliberate, responsible approach to these standards. And I also know you've had various levels of contact with the SEC, with FINRA, the AICPA, and other parties. Could you just briefly describe the extent of your discussions with these parties and give us a bit of the flavor of your discussions? Because I know they've been thorough.
Sure. We've discussed this program and all aspects of what we might do in the broker-dealer area with the SEC extensively. We've met with their Office of Chief Accountant, their Division of Trading and Markets, and other folks over at the SEC and a variety of different offices and divisions. They're very well aware of what's going on. We talk to them frequently about what's happening. We've talked with the FINRA people. They've been very cooperative, very helpful. As a matter of fact, they've provided us with a tremendous amount of data, which, again, in the funding area has been particularly helpful, and we'll talk about that again in a few minutes. So far as the AICPA, we've talked with their experts panel and other people from the AICPA. I think, actually, though, they'll probably be more useful once we get into standard setting as opposed to the inspection process or funding, but we have been talking with them. I think we've talked with SIPC, we've talked with just about everyone we can think about or think of to go out and outreach to. And then along those lines, I think that we are making efforts to participate in conferences and have other communication with representatives of the broker-dealer industry whenever we can. So we're going to continue those communications. We're going to continue to try to contact not only the regulators, but other people in the industry, and keep getting as much data and information as we can get.
Good. Thank you.
Would you?
Sure, I'm finished.
You're absolutely right that it's a lot easier to, in general, it is a lot easier to measure the costs and the benefits, except in this instance, there's an insurance program out there called CIVIC. And at one level, a measure of the success or failure of this program will be what happens to the insurance program. Now, granted, as I made it, to repeat a point I made a moment ago, that insurance has limits and investors can lose more, can still be at risk, even with the existence of CIVIC. But I would say that over time, I'm not anticipating this, but if over time the losses to CIVIC are not significantly reduced once our program is in full operation, questions may be raised about whether this whole effort is worthwhile. Those are questions that ultimately would have to be decided by the Congress, I would say. But that's a very different situation from what we have with regard to issuer audits, where it's highly speculative, in fact almost impossible to measure in a direct way the influence, the effect on investors. We do attempt to measure through restatements and things of that kind, and or adverse of 404B audits and so forth. But here it's a very different situation, and I think it's going to be a real test for this organization long term because of the relationship to the insurance fund.
Yes, Mr. Niemeyer.
One thing on it, this broker-dealer issue is certainly interesting when it comes to cost-benefit. And I think it will take time to sort of figure it out. I think what you've said, Mr. Grandison, about CIVIC is going to be relevant. Still in the mix, though, it's just what is the credibility of the marketplace worth? There's factors that go into a cost-benefit analysis like this. And I don't know that it's easy to measure, but yet to become very valuable to consider when you start looking at what impact you have in a program like ours and what value it adds. So I think it's going to be something, again, we'll just have to see how this plays out.
All right, if there's no further discussion, the motion before the board is to instruct the staff to release the proposed temporary inspection rule for broker-dealer audits for public comment for 60 days. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. The second item on the agenda is a recommendation that the board propose amendments to its funding rules. And for that recommendation, I'll turn again to our general counsel's office, Mr. Gordon Seymour.
Thank you, Chairman Gelzer. on behalf of the Office of General Counsel, I'm pleased to recommend that the board propose amendments to its funding rules. Since the board's inception, the primary source of the board's funds has been what the Sarbanes-Oxley Act calls the board's accounting support fee. As required by the Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among public companies and investment companies based on their relative equity market capitalizations. As we've been discussing today, the Dodd-Frank Act assigned the board the additional responsibility to oversee the audit of broker-dealers. To pay for that oversight, Dodd-Frank directs the board to allocate the accounting support fee among not only public companies and investment companies, but also among brokers and dealers. The proposals we're presenting today would implement those provisions of Dodd-Frank and provide for a portion of the board's accounting support fee to be allocated among securities brokers and dealers. We're also recommending today certain changes to the existing rules applicable to the portion of the accounting support fee that would continue to be allocated among public companies and investment companies. These changes are based on 8 years of experience administering the funding rules and are designed to make the funding process both more efficient and more cost-effective for all concerned. Nina Majeri-Azad, Assistant General Counsel, and Annie Braswell, Accounting Supervisor in the Office of Finance, will present the staff's recommendation. Before I turn the floor over to Nina and Annie, though, I would like to acknowledge the work of both Nina and Annie, as well as, again, Bob Burns from the Office of General Counsel. Bob, Annie, and Nina have spent countless hours analyzing the Dodd-Frank Act, crunching the numbers, and doing everything else that went into putting this proposal together. I also want to acknowledge the substantial assistance we've received from other offices on this proposal. In particular, I want to thank Tim Gustafson, Elena Bajkova, and Kevin Murphy of our Office of Research and Analysis for their work obtaining and analyzing significant amounts of data related to broker-dealers. Also, Naveen Hanumansetti of our IT department has assisted us in gathering, compiling, and doing quality checks on the data that we use. And with that, let me turn things over to Nina to present the proposal.
Thank you, Gordon. Chairman Gelzer and members of the board, as Gordon stated, the Dodd-Frank Act amended Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to require for the equitable allocation, assessment, and collection by the board of its accounting support fee among issuers and brokers and dealers. As reflected in the 2011 budget recently approved by the board, which is subject to commission approval, the board's total accounting support fee for 2011 is allocated between issuers and brokers and dealers. The Dodd-Frank amendments require that the basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee among brokers and dealers or classes of brokers and dealers be based on their relative net capital before or after any adjustments compared to the total net capital of all brokers and dealers before or after any adjustments. The reference to adjustments permits the board to allocate the fee based on tentative net capital, which is net capital before deducting certain securities haircuts and changes in inventory used in calculating the broker or dealer's net capital. Because the investment decisions made by a broker or dealer can influence the amount of these deductions and thus influence the net capital calculation, we believe that tentative net capital may be a more consistent basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee than net capital. Accordingly, we are recommending that the board base the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee among brokers and dealers based on tentative net capital. Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, as amended by the Dodd-Frank Act, also allows the board to differentiate among classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes, just as the board has been permitted to do for issuers. Differentiating brokers and dealers by classes allows the board to allocate the broker-dealer accounting support fee to those brokers and dealers whose audits, due to their relative size and complexity, may require more board time and resources during an inspection than other audits of brokers and dealers with relatively small and less complex operations. To allow for the equitable distribution of the broker-dealer accounting support fee, we recommend that the board propose to create two classes of brokers and dealers. Class 1 would include brokers or dealers with average quarterly tentative net capital greater than $5 million. Class 2 would include brokers or dealers with average quarterly tentative net capital less than or equal to $5 million, or those that do not file audited financial statements pursuant to a commission rule or other action of the commission or its staff. Brokers and dealers falling under Class 2 would be allocated a share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee equal to zero. Brokers and dealers in Class 1 would be allocated a share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee based on a ratio where the numerator is the average quarterly tentative net capital of the broker-dealer for the calendar quarter of the immediately prior calendar year, and the denominator is the sum of the average quarterly tentative net capital of all brokers and dealers in the class. Based on data received from FINRA, the staff anticipate that under this proposed $5 million threshold, approximately 15% of the broker-dealer population would be in Class 1 and assess the fee. We are also recommending that the board propose amendments to the board's current rules regarding the assessment and collection of the accounting support fee to include appropriate references to brokers and dealers. For example, currently, if a share of the accounting support fee allocated to an issuer is past due and the issuer has not filed a petition with the board seeking correction of its assigned share, then, with certain exceptions, no registered public accounting firm is permitted to sign an unqualified audit opinion with respect to that issuer's financial statements or to sign a consent to the use of prior audit opinion for that issuer. Under the proposal before you today, the same concept would be extended to brokers and dealers in that no registered public accounting firm would be permitted to sign an unqualified audit opinion with respect to that broker or dealer's financial statements, sign a consent to the use of a prior audit opinion, or sign an audit report or a document, report, notice, or other record concerning procedures or controls for that broker-dealer if its share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee is past due and no petition for correction has been filed. In addition, similar to issuers, brokers and dealers would be assessed monthly finance charges at a rate of 6% per year if they have an outstanding balance after 60 days of the date of their invoice. If a broker-dealer has an outstanding balance after the 90th day of the original invoice date, then the board may report nonpayment through the commission or the issuer's or broker's designated examining authority. In addition to the above recommendations related to the broker-dealer accounting support fee, we are also recommending certain amendments to the board's existing rules for the allocation, assessment, and collection of the issuer accounting support fee. As you know, the board has conducted its funding under these rules since 2003. While the rules generally have functioned as intended, we believe that the allocation and assessment process could be more efficient in some respects. Annie will discuss most of the proposed amendments to the board's funding rules with respect to issuers. However, I would like to highlight one proposed change for your attention. As required under Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among issuers based on their relative average monthly equity market capitalizations. Under the board's current rules, an issuer's market capitalization is based on the aggregate market value of all classes of the issuer's common stock that trade in the United States. Determining whether certain types of securities not identified as common stock, such as limited partnership interests, should be included in an issuer's market capitalization, however, has led to interpretive issues. To reduce such issues, we are recommending that the board propose amending the definition of issuer market capitalization and market capitalization of an issuer by replacing the reference to common stock with a reference to voting and non-voting common equity. Thus, an issuer's market cap would be based on the issuer's aggregate market value of all classes of voting and non-voting common equity traded in the United States. The term common equity would track the definition of Rule 12b-2 under the Exchange Act, which includes any class of common stock or an equivalent interest, including but not limited to a unit of beneficial interest in a trust or a limited partnership interest. Therefore, under this proposal, an issuer's market capitalization will be slightly expanded to include not only any class of common stock or equivalent interest, but also any beneficial interest in a trust or limited partnership interest, and any other security that the Commission, by rule, deems to treat as common equity. Preferred stock, warrants, and options would continue to be excluded when calculating an issuer's market capitalization. I would now like to turn it over to Annie, who will describe other proposed amendments to the Board's funding rules concerning issuers.
Thank you, Nina. In addition to the modification of the definition of issuer market capitalization, the amendments before the Board propose an increase in the market cap thresholds for issuer classes 1 and 2. Issuers in these classes are allocated portions of the issuer accounting support fee based on their relative average monthly market capitalizations. Currently, Class 1 issuers include public companies with average monthly U.S. market cap more than $25 million each, and Class 2 includes investment companies with average monthly net asset value or U.S. market cap greater than $250 million each. The proposal would increase the market cap thresholds from $25 million to $75 million for Class 1 issuers, which includes public companies, and from $250 million to $500 million for Class 2 issuers, which includes investment companies. We believe the increase in these thresholds allows for a more efficient funding process and reduces administrative burdens on the smaller issuers, with minimal effect on the assessments to other issuers. Additionally, we are proposing modifications to the consideration of issuers that are in bankruptcy and meet the modified reporting requirements of SEC Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2, whereby they are not required to file audited financial statements with the Commission. These issuers fall under the third class of issuers and are allocated a share of the accounting support fee equal to zero. In a number of instances, companies in bankruptcy who file modified reports will notify the PCAOB that they meet the conditions for modified reporting under Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 and should be allocated a share of the accounting support fee equal to zero. It is difficult, however, for PCAOB staff to verify such assertions since there is no requirement in Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 or elsewhere that an issuer ask for no action relief or otherwise receive acknowledgement from the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance prior to filing modified reports. Rather, we understand that such issuers that believe that they meet the conditions in Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 may choose to file modified reports with the Commission. To avoid PCAOB staff having to determine whether or not a bankrupt issuer meets the conditions set forth in that legal bulletin, the proposed amendments would clarify that in order to be placed in Class 3, an issuer in bankruptcy that asserts to the PCAOB that it meets modified reporting requirements of Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 must provide an opinion of counsel that the issuer met those requirements on the date that the accounting support fee was calculated. Further, the proposed amendments would extend the time frame within which an issuer, broker, or dealer may petition the board for correction of the class in which it's been placed or its allocated share of the accounting support fee. The current funding rules permit petitions for correction to be received within 30 days of the invoice date. However, staff has found over the past funding cycles that issuers rarely deliver petitions to the board within those 30 days, and staff typically has accepted and considered petitions received after that point. The proposed amendments extend that time frame in which issuers, brokers, and dealers may file a petition with the board from 30 days to 60 days. In addition, the proposal would allow acceptance of petitions for correction past the 60 days when due cause is shown. Finally, with regard to a registered accounting firm ascertaining that its issuer, broker, or dealer client has paid its share of the accounting support fee, the proposed amendments would clarify that it is not mandatory that a registered accounting firm obtain confirmation from the board prior to signing an unqualified audit opinion, consenting to include an audit report issued previously, or signing a document, report, notice, or other record concerning procedures or controls of its issuer, broker, or dealer client. Rather, the firm may ascertain that its client has paid through various other means. As such, the proposed amendments replace the word confirmation with the word determination in the caption for Rule 7104B, and remove specific reference to obtaining confirmation from the board. This proposed modification is in recognition that confirmation is only one of a number of procedures available to a registered public accounting firm when determining whether its client has any outstanding past due share of the accounting support fee. Under the Dodd-Frank amendments to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the PCAOB is required to begin allocation, assessment, and collection of the accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund its first fiscal year after the date the Dodd-Frank Act enactment, which is the 2011 calendar year. As such, we expect that subject to approval of the funding rules by the SEC, the funding rules would be effective for the 2011 funding cycle for brokers and dealers and for the 2012 funding cycle for issuers. We are recommending that the board publish for public comment these proposed amendments for a 60-day period. Accordingly, all comments must be received no later than February 15, 2011. We will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Majuri-Assad and Ms. Braswell. Let me turn to the other members of the board then and ask if there are any motions concerning this matter.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Harris.
I move that the board instruct the staff to release the proposed amendments to the board's funding rules as recommended for public comment for a period of 60 days.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Gradison. Let me make some comments about this proposal. The primary purpose of the proposed amendments to the funding rules that are before the board for consideration today is to create a framework for obtaining the resources necessary to support the cost of the board's oversight of auditors of securities brokers and dealers. When Congress created the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board in 2002, it gave the board responsibility to oversee the auditors of U.S. public companies and provided that the board's work would be funded by those public companies in proportion to each issuer's market capitalization. This summer, in the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress expanded the board's responsibilities to include the auditors of all SEC-registered securities brokers and dealers. Building on the 2002 approach to board self-funding, Dodd-Frank provides that the board is to equitably allocate its resources between public companies and broker-dealers. Broker-dealers are required to contribute to their industry's share of board funding in proportion to net capital. Broker-dealer net capital is highly concentrated. As I noted in my statement this morning regarding the interim inspection program, only 33 firms have net capital in excess of $1 billion, and those firms hold about 80% of the net capital of the entire broker-dealer industry. The great majority of brokerage firms, however, are very small. Under any allocation methodology that's based on a firm's share of total industry net capital, several thousand broker-dealers would pay nothing simply because of the board's practice of rounding fee allocations to the nearest $100. Under the proposed funding rules, only broker-dealers that have tentative net capital in excess of $5 million would be allocated a share of the board's accounting support fee. Of the 5,000 or so SEC-registered broker-dealers, about 640 firms currently exceed the $5 million threshold. The board has estimated that in 2011, about 7.1% of its budget, or roughly $15 million, will be devoted to the oversight of broker-dealer auditors. As a result, under the proposed rule, in 2011, brokerage firm support fees would range from a low of $400 to a high of about $1.2 million. Roughly 100 of the 640 firms would pay $500 or less. Three firms would pay over $1 million. As we've heard, a secondary purpose of the proposed funding rule amendments is to revise the rules related to public company support fees. While the proposals include several technical changes, the aspect of those revisions that will have the greatest practical effect is the proposed increase in the market capitalization threshold. Under the current rules, all public companies that have market capitalizations of at least $25 million must contribute to the funding of the board's issuer auditor oversight work. The proposal before the board today would increase that threshold to $75 million, the same as the SEC threshold for accelerated filer status. As a result, about 1,100 issuers with market capitalizations between $25 million and $75 million will no longer be subject to the support fee allocation. Granting relief to these small public companies will have only a negligible impact on the support fee payments of larger issuers, since public companies with market capitalizations below $75 million currently pay, as a group, only about 0.4% of the board's total accounting support fee. The proposed revisions would also increase the market capitalization, or actually net asset value, threshold from $250 million to $500 million for investment companies. That change would have the effect of reducing to zero the fee allocation of about 1,480 investment companies. I believe that the proposed broker-dealer funding rules and the changes to the public company funding rules are fully consistent with Congress's objective of requiring that public companies and broker-dealers provide the resources for board oversight of their auditors. The proposals would accomplish that goal without burdening smaller public companies, smaller broker-dealers, and smaller investment companies. I support the proposed funding rule changes. These amendments were a joint effort of the Office of the General Counsel and the Office of Finance. I want to also join in thanking Bob Burns, Associate General Counsel, Nina Mojari-Assad, Assistant General Counsel, and Annie Braswell, Accounting Supervisor in the Office of Finance, for their work on this project. Let me ask the other board members if they have comments or questions. And Mr. Harris, I'll begin with you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me emphasize what you've already so clearly explained, and that is, as with the proposed temporary rule for an interim program of inspections, the proposed fee structure we are considering today is highly considerate of the financial burden on smaller broker-dealers. As Nina, Allison, and you have said, to date, the primary source of board funds has been the accounting support fee paid by public companies and investment companies. The Dodd-Frank Act specifies that the cost of the board's expanded responsibility should be allocated among brokers and dealers. And the Act allows the board to differentiate among classes of broker-dealers. It requires that the amount be calculated based on relative net capital before or after certain adjustments, in other words, tentative net capital. The board's proposing release contains information obtained from the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, which shows that the majority of tentative net capital in the industry is highly concentrated in relatively few companies. Indeed, approximately 86% of broker-dealers have about 1% of the industry's capital, and conversely, 99% of the industry's tentative net capital is held by just 14% of the industry. The board is proposing, as you've mentioned, to exclude brokers and dealers with tentative net capital of less than $5 million, 86% of the industry, from the accounting support fee. Therefore, under today's proposal, those smaller broker-dealers would not receive an invoice from the PCOB. The board is making similar proposals in the funding rules regarding the fees paid by public companies and investment companies. Currently, companies under a certain market capitalization are not allocated a portion of the accounting support fee. As explained in the release and as discussed earlier under the proposal, these market capitalization thresholds would be raised, and as a result, the number of companies that do not receive an invoice from the PCOB would increase. As a group, it is expected that this proposed reallocation would have a negligible effect on the fees allocated to other companies. In summary, the board's proposals today, the inspection program and funding rules, reflect the board's sensitivity to the costs that may be imposed on smaller entities while maintaining our primary focus on investor protection. I look forward to receiving the comments on both proposals and to moving forward with the development of our broker-dealer audit oversight programs. And before I close, I would like to join you, Mr. Chairman, in thanking the staff for their efforts and thorough analysis in developing these proposed rules before us today. In particular, I would like to thank our general counsel, Gordon Seymour, Michael Stevenson, Bob Burns, and Nina Majuri-Azad from the general counsel's office, and Annie Braswell from the finance office, and on the prior recommendations, George Giacant and Bob Modé, and the research and analysis division, and others who have been referenced to my reflect, who I don't recall the exact names of, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris. Mr. Gradison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand, the statute commands us to come up with an equitable allocation of these costs between issuers and the broker-dealers, which on its surface suggests that they're two different classes of organizations, but they're really not. It isn't that clear, as near as I can think this through, that they're either fish or they're fowl. And that is because in a typical situation today involving most, if not all, of the large broker-dealers, they're already subject to inspections. There's a publicly held holding company, and then beneath that there is a broker-dealer. And I've been trying to figure out, we'll get comments on this if there are any concerns on the outside. I'm just trying to think whether I should have any concerns about this, because the funding scheme relies upon the funds from the big ones, many of whom, I'm not saying all, but many of whom are parts of public companies, to pay the costs of the inspections for this large universe, many of whom, quite properly, are being exempted from paying anything at all. So I guess my key question is, because the statute refers to an equitable allocation, will there be significantly more costs incurred by our inspection division in taking a look at public broker-dealers as a result of this new legislation than there have been in the past when they were being inspected because of their being, in many cases, the whole operating part of an issuer?
Yeah, let me talk about that for a minute. It's an interesting question, and it's one, as you know, in the budget process, I think the board has been thinking about quite thoroughly. I think so far as when PCOB inspectors go out to look at an entity, an issuer that has a broker-dealer subsidiary, and they're going to actually include some of those audits in their program to go out and do it. And hopefully they will do this all at one time. In other words, as I understand it, and although Bob Madej and others can explain this better than I can, it will probably be part of one trip, so to speak, out to the issuer and to the subsidiary, and they hope to do it all at one time and kind of wrap it up in one inspection. So we hope to keep costs reduced to that extent. It really depends on how the inspection program for broker-dealers is developed and what they decide should be looked at and how it goes into. A lot of that we really won't know until we get through the interim inspection program to decide where the real risks are and what needs to be examined and what types of operations within these broker-dealers pose the real risk, what types of broker-dealers warrant more time than other broker-dealers. So, unfortunately, the answer to your question right now is one that I can't really give you a definitive answer to. I think that we're going to be studying those questions. I think over the next year or so, hopefully, we'll come up with a lot better answers. We'll come up with a program that we think will do the job, at the same time not impose any unreasonable burden or cost on the people involved. But it's going to be an evolving process, and it's one that's going to actually feed into the standards that we write, to the inspection program, to all, the whole setup as we go forward. So if your question is how we're going to manage the cost involved and how we're going to, the inspection program is going to work and how they're going to actually do it, we will be looking at that.
Just if I could to add to what Bob said, the premise for the proposal today is as you reflected, Board Member Gradison, in your question, that there would be a separate bill in the situation you're describing of a issuer holding company and a broker-dealer subsidiary. Those two, and those would be two separate legal entities, each with their own treated separately, each with their own obligations under the securities laws, each with their own audit requirement, they would, under this proposal, receive two separate bills. You're correct, there could be some overlap in the audit work we might look at as part of the issuer audit and at least our inspection work on the broker-dealer's financial statement audit. At the same time, there might not be overlap. There might be some work for the broker-dealer's financial statement audit that wouldn't be looked at as part of our looking at the issuer's audit engagement. Probably more significantly, there are additional engagements the auditor has to perform under the securities laws for the broker-dealer, as you well know, the compliance-type work that has to be done that would be part of our inspection program and our general oversight of the broker-dealer's audit that would not be captured today in our issuer audit program. So that's the premise for the approach before you, but again, we're certainly open to receiving comments on this point.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gradison. Mr. Niemeyer.
Sure. Well, to start, Annie, Nina, Bob, you've done a great job on this, working up this proposal. I'd also like to thank, though, the many other staff in the Office of Finance, the General Counsel's Office, and IT, who operate our funding process every year. No doubt our funding process is critical to our ability to maintain effective programs. And yet the process runs so smoothly that from the outside it might appear to be effortless to us. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Act requires us to allocate our accounting support fee across public companies according to the relative market cap. Obtaining and managing the data necessary to calculate each company's assessment is an enormous job in and of itself. But then there's collection. On average each year, more than 90% of our fee is collected within 60 days of billing. But under the Act and related rules, our staff still has to track down and work through the reasons for non-payment by a few hundred issuers, with, for the most part, relatively small amounts to collect right off. That in itself is another enormous task. Our funding process does take considerable time every year, including the time of key employees. This process will now have to occur twice a year because of the addition of broker-dealer assessments, which, as described in the proposal, requires completely different information and analysis to calculate. The proposed rules benefit from your experience operating the issuer funding process over the years, and I support it. Your proposed appropriate classes and thresholds consistent with the Dodd-Frank Act, which to the extent possible would result in accessing an optimal number of broker-dealers to keep fees low relative to tentative net capital while avoiding the administrative cost of a high level of very small bills. I also support the amendments you propose to improve the issuer funding rules based on the 8 cycles of experience and to conserve valuable staff and other resources for tasks more directly related to our programs. I look forward to public comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Let me ask a couple questions about the proposal. First, at least if the numbers in my statement were correct, and if the rule is ultimately adopted, about 640 brokerage firms can expect to receive a notice from the PCAOB. When would you anticipate that those would go out in 2011?
Section 109D of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, as amended, states that the board is to begin allocation assessment and collection of the accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund the first full fiscal year after the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act, which would be the 2011 funding cycle. So we are hoping that the board would approve or adopt, and the SEC will approve the funding rules as amended in the first half of 2011. And then we would have the opportunity to assess and collect the accounting support fee within the second half of 2011.
So sometime in, I would guess the fall.
Yes, we're expecting the fall time frame.
We send the issuer accounting support fee notices, well, I guess usually in late March, early April, somewhere in that time frame. After 2011, would you envision that the broker-dealer support fee notices would go on the same schedule, or will they continue to be at a different time of year?
After 2011, we're not certain that they would go out at the same time. We do, as you mentioned, conduct that in the issuer accounting support fee assessment in the first half of the year. And for brokers and dealers, we would need to look at the availability of data from external data providers, and as well as some other factors that would go into that to determine
if that is feasible, to assess them around the same time. Regardless, the staff always strives to conduct the assessment process in the most cost-efficient manner.
Okay, well, since you mentioned the data, and as I understand it, we're able to get the market capitalization data that we use for the issuer accounting support fee from, I guess, basically commercial sources. How are we going to get tentative net capital information? Are there commercial sources for that, too?
Well, tentative capital is reported on focus reports, and those reports essentially go to FINRA and other designated examining authorities for broker-dealers. So we've been getting data from FINRA, and we're working out agreements to get it from the other examining authorities as well. So we will hopefully get it directly from them.
Do those FINRA and the other examining authorities get that information electronically, or will it have to be?
It comes in electronic.
We get electronic. There was some discussion on the previous item about our ability ultimately to exempt some categories of broker-dealer auditors from PCAOB oversight. What effect would that have on the brokerage firms that those auditors audit from a support fee perspective? In other words, if you're in a category where your auditor is exempted, are you still at least in theory subject to receiving a support fee
assessment? No. The reason is in Section 109, it uses the term broker and it uses the term dealer, but when you look at the definition of those terms, as it was added to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act by the Dodd-Frank Act, it essentially means brokers and dealers who are required to have a registered public accounting firm do their audit. So if you're not required to have a registered public accounting firm do your audit, you're not within the definition of broker within Section 109, which means you're not subject to the fee. So they're out.
Okay. Mr. Grandison brought out one point that I wanted to ask you about, and that is the potential for one holding company, one corporate family to receive more than one assessment, one as a public company and one because of having a broker-dealer affiliate. Do you know if there are any financial conglomerates that have more than one broker-dealer affiliate? There's certainly nothing impossible about that. So there could be entities that would receive more than two assessments, multiple assessments.
Yeah, I honestly don't know whether they have more than one broker-dealer. I think it would be, the billing would probably depend on how they're regulated and how they file focus reports and how they're overseen by FINRA and the SEC, because to be perfectly honest, that's what we're using as part of the funding process.
Maybe some mutual funds could be in that situation too, if they have a sub that's handling the trades for just that fund.
Right. And yeah. So we do, you know, expect, obviously, the first time around, we may hear from some and have to consider some of those issues once it comes up.
I suppose there's nothing really very novel. But I mean, the large fund complexes must receive numerous assessments from us because each fund is separately.
Right. We invoice at the series level, so a trust may receive several invoices.
I wanted to ask about the consequences of non-payment, and Nina, I think you covered that in your comments in terms of the inability to sign an audit report. If I recall correctly, there's a direct obligation in Section 13, I think, of the Exchange Act to pay. In other words, the SEC can bring an enforcement action against an entity that doesn't pay. That's sort of the ultimate sanction. Is there something comparable with respect to the broker-dealer assessments, or is the reliance going to be solely on this inability to get audits signed?
Yeah. Well, Section 109H1 of Sarbanes-Oxley provides that each broker and dealer shall pay to the board the annual accounting support fee. As I mentioned in my statement, we will report non-payments to the SEC or the broker-dealer's designated examining agency, and at that point they would be able to take any action that they see reasonable.
Okay, so I guess ultimately SEC enforcement action is the shotgun behind the door here, I guess. I'm not sure they've ever brought any on the issue because I know they've threatened them sometimes, which has had the effect of bringing the money in from non-payers. Let me switch for a minute to the issuer funding rule changes. Yeah, again, I think you described the difference between common stock and common equities. I won't cover that again. But you also commented that other classes of equity, like preferred stock and stock warrants, aren't included in our definition, I guess because of the use of the word common. Why is that? Why not include preferred stock, for example, in determining assessments?
Sure. Certain types of securities, such as preferred stock, warrants, and options, may represent an obligation on the part of the issuer rather than be a component of the issuer's equity, and therefore it's not clear whether that would fall under the Section 109 requirement that an issuer's equity market capitalization be considered when allocating the issuer accounting support fee.
Two other things. First, we're the collection agent for the FASB, whose budget is funded essentially in the same way from issuers. How will the FASB be affected by these rule changes? I mean, I guess they won't be affected by the broker-dealer rule change at all, but will the base for their support fee change with respect to common stock versus common equity in the same way that ours will?
Sure. As you noted, the issuers would be required to pay the FASB accounting support fee. However, brokers and dealers would not, and it would continue going forward that way. The FASB did designate us as their collection agent, and in doing so, designated that the allocation formula set forth in our funding rules would be used for their allocation of the accounting support fee. So any changes to the issuer funding rules that we've referenced today that are in the amendment would be effectively the same for the FASB accounting support fee assessment as well.
Do they have to agree to that?
Discussed the proposed amendments with FASB, and they're aware of these changes.
Sarbanes Oxley provides for them to be funded in the same manner as the PCOB. They've voluntarily agreed to designate us as their collection agent. Theoretically, they could choose someone else, but given that it's the same methodology, we need to, at a general level, the level of the Act, that we need to use for our issuer funding, it does make a lot of sense for, as a matter of efficiency, for them to use us for this purpose, and I think we'd expect that to continue.
Well, that was my question. Do they have to agree to these changes?
No, I think at the FAF, the Financial Accounting Foundation level, I think they've pretty much indicated that they look to the PCOB's rules so far as determination of the fee and calculation, that kind of thing. So I think they've essentially already bought in, so to speak, to the PCOB's methodologies and so on. And we did, as Nina indicated, or it's been indicated before, we did share this with them. We've talked with the General Counsel's office. They have indicated to us, at least at this point in time, again, this is a proposal, but they've indicated to us that they have no issues. Satisfied with it. So,
do you have any sense of how this will affect individual issuers, individual public companies? I mean, are there companies out there that are likely to see their assessment go significantly up or significantly down because of this common stock versus common equity change?
Well, as you mentioned in your statement, only about 1,100 public companies on average over the past six funding cycles fall within that $25 million to $75 million market cap range. And that's about 23% of the equity issuers out there that were assessed a portion of the fee. However, they only paid about 0.4% of the total accounting support fee on average over those six cycles. Similarly, for investment companies, there are about 33% that fall in the $250 to $500 million market cap range. And they only ended up paying about 0.3% on average of the total accounting support fee. So essentially, they're paying less than 1% of the total accounting support fee, and allocating that over 2,500 issuers is not efficient for us, and also inflicts a burden on the smaller companies that, when you reallocate that to the other issuers, it's not a big burden that they take on. And I would note that in looking at the numbers, companies with typically $600 million or more would see an increase in their fee range, in their fee, companies with $600 million market cap and above. So those below that typically do not see, in general, an increase in their fee.
Well, I'm with you on that, and I'm glad you make those
points because I like those 1,100 public companies and 1,460 or whatever it is investment companies to know that they're going out of the system. But I guess my question is slightly different, and that is the change from common stock to common equity likely to have a significant effect on anybody remaining in the system? I perhaps we don't know the answer to that.
Right, yeah. Right now, we don't necessarily have the answer to that. As we mentioned, there's a lot of interpretive questions that has been posed when we're operating under the common stock market cap definition, and we'll be looking at that during the 2011 funding cycle.
Just offhand, I suppose I'm the least informed person in the room to answer the question, but I would think that when you put the change together with the way the staff has been interpreting the rule, it isn't likely to have a significant effect on the
That's what I was going to add. I think the way that we've been interpreting it, I don't think this will result in much of a change. I think what we're trying to do is make the rule clearer as to what we really intend, because there were a lot of questions as to what does common stock, that phrase, actually mean in the funding rules. And I think in answering all those questions that come up, I think we've gotten closer, certain occasion, to where the SEC has been on determining what common equity might be. So.
Just one last thing. I mean, Mr. Neumeyer made the point about all the work that has to go on behind the scenes here in order to get the accounting support fee notices out and how well that's operated over the last cycles. A lot of that, a significant part of that occurs in the IT part of our operation. What are going to be the internal ramifications, particularly the IT ramifications of creating the broker-dealer funding system? Does that mean a new system has to be built, and how well prepared are we to do that by the second half of the year?
Well, we've initiated discussions with the Office of Information Technology to determine how best to implement the assessment of the broker-dealer accounting support fee. It's not clear at this point whether or not we'd be able to use the current funding system and expand that to allow for broker-dealer assessment. But we, again, have begun talks and do not foresee that that would, you know, either if it's creating a new system or implementing changes to the current funding system, that it would delay us or keep us from assessing the accounting support fee for brokers and dealers in the second half of 2011.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion or comments?
I was wondering, how did you come up with just the two classes of broker-dealers? What were some of the factors that you considered in creating just those two?
Sure. As we mentioned, we obtained data from FINRA for about 4,600 broker-dealers, and we looked at the tentative net capital, the dispersion of broker-dealers with for tentative net capital. And as has been mentioned, a significant number, roughly about 4,000, have less than $5 million tentative net capital, while only a small percentage, only 33, hold 80% of the tentative net capital in the broker-dealer population. We had looked at the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee using no threshold, and under that scenario, assuming a $15 million broker-dealer accounting support fee, we noted that approximately 3,000 of the broker-dealers would not be assessed the fee, sometime due to the rounding of our in our rules. If we had increased, when we increased the threshold to 5 million, 919 additional broker-dealers would not have been, would not be assessed a fee. However, the total fee that those 919 broker-dealers that would have been paying under the no threshold would have been only roughly about $140,000, which is less than 1%. And we felt that distributing that less than 1% fee to the 640 broker-dealers that are above the $5 million net capital, tentative net capital, is very negligible impact on their bills.
Steve, can I interject something about that just before you go? I think we say in another part of the comments today that about 500 firms either clear or have custody of client assets, which is actually a higher number than I would have thought, but I think we have that at least roughly from somewhere. And that 460 firms are going to be paying the support fee. Do we know if those two pretty much overlap? In other words, that we won't be assessing introducing firms that don't have custody of client assets?
I don't think that we can tell you with any degree of certainty that that's the case. I think we assume that there's some relationship there, but I couldn't tell you for certain.
I would think that there would, well, there may be some exceptions, that there would be pretty close overlap between those.
I would guess so, but I don't know.
And Annie, I think I missed your explanation here. In terms of when you raised the threshold from $75 million and $500 million, it will not have a significant impact on the remaining companies that have to pay a fee. But could you explain again why that's the case?
Well, the companies, for public companies, that fall between the range, based on the last six funding cycles, between the range of $25 million and $75 million in market cap, they only pay about 0.4% of the total accounting support fee. Additionally, investment companies over the past six funding cycles have, on average, paid only 6% in total of the accounting support fee. And then of that, the number of investment companies that fall within the $250 million to $500 million range, it's about 1,500 companies. That's 33% of the investment companies that are assessed a portion of the fee. However, they only pay 5% of the total amount assessed to investment companies. So that's essentially 0.3% of the total accounting support fee. So allocating that less than 1% to those 2,500 companies that we would be excluding, we find that it's not as efficient as it could be if we were exclude those 2,500 companies and the lower, smaller companies to decrease the burden on them and also make the funding process more efficient without having much of an effect on those larger, the other companies that would be assessed portions of the fees.
Thank you. And I want to associate myself with Mr. Niemeyer's remarks. You never know when there's going to be a glitch in the system, and inevitably there are glitches in the system, but I think our allocation and collection process here is done extraordinarily well, and so I want to thank the staff and everybody involved in it and in making it work the way it does.
Thank you. If there isn't any other discussion, then the motion before the board is to direct the staff to release the proposed funding rules and funding rule changes for public comment for 60 days. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. That's the end of our agenda for today, but before we adjourn, I'd like to make a brief statement about another matter, and that matter is the establishment of a new Office of Outreach and Small Business Liaison. As we've already discussed today, the Dodd-Frank Act vested the board with the authority over the auditors of all SEC-registered securities brokers and dealers. The great majority of the more than 500 additional accounting firms that have registered with the board because they perform broker-dealer audits are, like their broker-dealer clients, small businesses. Since beginning operations, the board has sought to maintain open lines of communication with the small business community. However, in light of the board's new authority and the large number of smaller accounting firms and broker-dealers that will be affected by it, the board has reassessed its communications and outreach strategy. As a result, the board has decided to establish an Office of Outreach and Small Business Liaison. This new office will act as a point of contact and communication between the board and any PCOB-registered public accounting firm or any other person affected by the board's regulatory activities, including, in particular, those in the small business community. In October, the board asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to approve the formation of this new office. On December 10th, last Friday, the commission issued an order approving the board's request. The new Office of Outreach will be responsible for planning and conducting a program of small business forums, including both the board's existing forums on auditing in the small business environment and new forums directed to the smaller broker-dealer and broker-dealer auditor communities. The office will also seek input from the small business community, including public companies, brokers, and others, on issues related to the board's work.
The office will serve as a communication channel for anyone with questions about the board's activities and will be charged with identifying areas where information related to board work is not well understood and suggesting action to address the issue. The director of the Office of Outreach and Small Business Liaison will report directly to the board's chairman. I'm very pleased to announce that Mary Soquist will serve as the office's first director. Mary has been with the board almost since its inception, first as counsel to board member Gradison, and then as the board's director of communications. She's been closely involved with issues relating to the small business community throughout her career, which has included working on small business issues as a lawyer in private practice and during her tenure in the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance. She's long played an active role in the Securities Subcommittee of the American Bar Association's Middle Market and Small Business Committee. I want to stress that the board's other communications functions, press relations, and government and congressional affairs, will continue to play an active role in the board's work. These functions, which were part of the Office of Communications, will be reconstituted as separate offices, the Office of Public Affairs and the Office of Government Relations. Colleen Brennan will head the Office of Public Affairs, and Kent Bonham will head the Office of Government Relations. I believe that this reorganization of our communications group will help to better serve the needs of both the small business community and others, including investors, who interact with the board or who are affected by its activities. I look forward to working with Mary in her new role. And we will be posting more information about the Office of Outreach and how to contact it on the board's website probably later today or tomorrow. That's all I have. Unless there are other questions or comments or business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.